He's 92 years old now, but the memories are still fresh in his mind. And today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, this World War II Navy corpsman recalls the somber duty he had to carry out in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor. He'll also explain this colorful quote from one of his famous patients.
They've never seen one before. They won't know what it is. If they have, it won't be anything new.
I'm Paul Leffler, inviting you to catch the rest of that story on Hometown Heroes, today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 o'clock on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ, whether you're listening at 1 o'clock on the AM side, 5 o'clock on the FM, or online anytime at KMJNow.com. You know that each week we visit with World War II veterans. We want to honor them for their service, for the sacrifices they've made for the sake of our freedom. We want to preserve their stories for posterity, and I think we each week get to learn a thing or two about what it was like to live back then, what it's like to be a member of our greatest generation. Over the years on this program, we've heard so many different perspectives. We've heard from sailors, airmen, foot soldiers, you name it. But it hasn't been too often that we've been able to tap into the perspective we'll get today. Someone who experienced firsthand the ugly and horrific human cost of war. Not on the front lines, but in naval hospitals. And someone who had a very unsavory job in the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Who at one point counted as one of his patients a man who had become one of World War II's legendary admirals. And a man who people in Kings County have known for the last 60 years as a kind and compassionate mortician at the Bledsoe Family People's Funeral Chapel. And we're going to go back in time now with 92-year-old Lloyd Bledsoe of Corcoran, California. Usually I take my guests back to December 7th, 1941, but I want to go a couple days before that because December 5th, 1941 was your 22nd birthday. I understand December 6th, 1941, you had your first date with a special young lady?
That's correct. Pat Bledsoe, or Pat Smith in those days.
You gave us the punchline already. I'm sure a war was nowhere near your mind that night on December 6th when you met this lovely lady for your first date.
No, the war wasn't, but it was there the next morning. And it wasn't her dad chasing me either.
What do you remember about that news, how you found out where you were and what it meant to you that America was under attack?
Well, I used to play the organ in the Christian Science Church in Huntington Beach, and I came home from church, and it was on the radio. And then I was, in those days, you got drafted or volunteered, and I was in the process of going into the Navy, and so... They called me up, and I said, I'll see you on the 2nd because I just met this lovely girl, and I want to take her to a couple of dances. And incidentally, while I'm on it, because I forget things, we danced to Tommy Dorsey, and with all due respect to a friend, Frank Sinatra, was a drunken bum. That's how I met him. And Lana Turner and some of the guys were in the band. I forget their names now, but... I went to school with him, and we used to have a dance band. I used to play the bass violin in it. But that's my claim to fame, knowing Frank when he was just nobody else knew him.
You went to high school with him?
No. He was singing with Tommy Dorsey at the Palladium. And they were there for a few weeks before Christmas, and they were supposed to go someplace else. But everybody wanted them to stay, and they stayed there. And then I went into the service. I went into the service to San Diego on the 20th of January. They would call me up to report for duty, and when I'd report, they'd say, "Oh, we don't have any billet for you. We got too many people coming in from Texas." All of Texas came. That place down there, I think every guy in Texas is in boot camp. I'm not kidding you. That was something else.
And on Frank Sinatra, so you're saying you and your wife went out to dance, and Frank Sinatra was singing there with Tommy Dorsey's band?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, that's the only, before anybody, he wasn't, he was just a singer, okay?
Well, here's a little treat for you. Maybe this will take you back there and also give our listeners a little feel for what that must have been like 70 years ago.
Sing you in all the places that this heart and mind embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well.
That, of course, the one and only Frank Sinatra with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, just as Lloyd and Pat heard it at the Palladium all those years ago. And I know that you do not want to share your Sinatra story on the record here, why you felt that way about him. But what about that other famous name you mentioned, one of the top movie stars of the 1940s, a young Hollywood starlet so popular that she would even have a B-17 bomber named after her. Tempest Turner, they called it, complete with a painting of a reclining Lana Turner on the nose. And Lana Turner was there that night, too. You even danced with her? How'd that happen?
She was there with a man, my wife went to the restroom or something. The place was packed, and we used to dancing with the other people. It was pretty informal. And so you'd have your date, but then half a dozen other people would dance with her, and you'd dance with other people maybe or that. And she was there, and she was looking at me, and I was looking at her, and I said, well, how about dancing? But my wife and I had been dancing in front of her and been cutting up, and so she wanted to do, asked me what we were doing, and I said, well, this is what it is, and it wasn't much of anything, but it was just jumping back and forth. But she thought that we had a little bit of fun. Then she went back to her friend, and then I told her I was in the service and was going to be gone. Just like that, I was leaving. This is my last night at the dance at there, and she gave me her address. And she says, well, she says, you want somebody to correspond with or something? And she'd write back and forth and that. And then,
and you would correspond for a while to the envy, I'm sure, of many a serviceman. More importantly, you were corresponding with Pat. And you were in the Navy now in early 1942. And what did the Navy want to do with you? What did they tell you your job was going to be?
Well, I was a licensed embalmer, and a lot of us that had a medical background were in the medical corps, but pharmacist mates in the Navy. And when you went in the reserve, well, according to your education, one thing or the other, you got a rating. You didn't start as an apprentice seaman. And I was to go in as a second class, but when I met my wife and didn't report the day that they wanted me to report, because I wasn't sworn in yet. And I said, well, no, I'm going to stay home and not get into the service because I want to be here for Christmas. And then I reported on the 2nd of January, and the boot camp was so full that they kept sending me home because I had a billet at home. But officially, I was in the service, and I got paid for that time. And I thought, boy, I'm getting paid for something here for nothing, in a sense. And I found out 27 months later when I came back from overseas, when I thought I was going to have paid leave and that, well, they cut me off. But I still got some leave, but I didn't get all the leave I was supposed to get. I got 30 days that you used to get, but anyway, that's it.
27 months. I'm sure there was a lot that happened in those 27 months. Was there a moment for you that was kind of the welcome to the Navy moment, where this is not all going to be fun and games, where you've got a pretty serious job to do that's going to be pretty challenging at times?
Oh, no, I don't know. I was lucky. I had very good duty. And at the hospital at Pearl Harbor, and then up at Aiea Heights, and then I came back to the States, and I was at San Leandro. When I was at Pearl Harbor, I had a deal with a friend named Tommy Moore that performed an appendectomy aboard a submarine. And that was my foot in the door going down to the sub base, and I'd go out on test dives when they'd come back and they'd take the submarines out of dry dock, and before they're going back to service, and I would be generally a volunteer corpsman because they didn't have anybody there assigned to that billet. But I was really stationed at Aiea Heights, and then. But I decided I didn't really want to go that route. Something, I don't know what happened, but something else changed my mind, and I came back to the States, and then I finally wound up in the Marine Corps, and my company in the Marine Corps where I'm at, the unit, we were on a board ship when the war got over, that we were on a direct ride in when they were going to take Japan, and it was a direct invasion. And it was a, boy, it was a, I don't know if any, if you have ever seen any of the pictures of the mass that was out there, but it was terrific. But I didn't get there. I just saw the pictures of that part.
And I'm going to ask you about that because I know that was a pretty imposing prospect. But let's talk about your first assignment there at Pearl Harbor. You're a chief pharmacist mate, a Navy corpsman at a naval hospital at Pearl Harbor. How long after December 7th was this? It was less than a year, I think, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was at Pearl Harbor. I had various jobs. And then I wound up being master at arms night quarters of sick officers' quarters. Admiral Halsey was my patient. Ensign Gay was the only person left out of torpedo 6 or 9 or something at Midway. And he, in fact, he and I were friends until he passed away a few years ago. He lived in Florida, but he used to come to Madeira when they had the fly-ins, and he and I used to get our heads together and say hello and old times and that. But he was the only survivor of, oh, I don't know how many at Midway. But of his unit, he was the last one in his squadron going in. It was a torpedo, dive bombers. And, of course, in those days, Lord, I had a plane after the war. My last plane I had was almost a better plane than they had that they were flying in those days.
Yep, I looked him up. That is Ensign George H. Gay, Jr., an ensign there. He would retire as a lieutenant commander eventually. But at the Battle of Midway, June 1942, he flew his TBD Devastator off the USS Hornet. And of the 30-member crew of Torpedo Squadron 8, that was the number, Torpedo Squadron 8, he was the only one who survived. Gay himself was shot down. His gunner was killed in the process. Gay survived floating in the water and hiding under his seat cushion when Japanese planes would come by strafing. He got to see the Americans sink those Japanese aircraft carriers before a PBY came and rescued him after 30 hours in the water. Gay eventually received the Navy Cross, the Purple Heart, and a Presidential Unit Citation. He later wrote a book about it called Soul Survivor, and he was one of the famous patients that Lloyd Bledsoe took care of at the hospital there at Pearl Harbor. That wasn't the only thing Lloyd did at Pearl Harbor. He'll share more about that and what he remembers about that other well-known patient, Admiral William Bull Halsey, when Hometown Heroes continues. 92-year-old Lloyd Bledsoe of Corcoran, California, our guest today. We'll be right back after a few words from our sponsors, like Fresno Distributing.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
History in every century records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
The Sammy Kay Orchestra there with Remember Pearl Harbor. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Lloyd Bledsoe of Corcoran, is 92 years old. He was not at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, but he was there just months later, and he had a job none of us would ask for. We'll get to that, but maybe, Lloyd, first you can take us there with you. Paint a little picture for us of what it was like. I'm interested in just, as a young man going over there, here you are, you know, 22, 23 years old, and you get to Pearl Harbor, and you know what's happened there. And I'm guessing you could still see oil on top of the water. There are probably still some signs of what had happened there. What did you see, and what did it mean to you?
Oh, yeah, the I'm gonna tell you the wrong thing, because I don't remember the name of the ships, but they were still tied up, sunken. Let's see, the Arizona was one of them. Because we went in, one of the worst assignments I ever had, the first one that I had over there, they were bringing body bags up and with remains. And we had to go, we were on the Aya Landing. And, God, I remember that like it was yesterday. And the stench was horrible. And we had to identify all these remains. And we had a lieutenant that was really demanding. And it was, I don't even get into it, but it was a very, very miserable job. And it made you think, what a waste, you know, really, when it's all over with. And then when you get to, like with me, and you reminisce and you look back and you think, as a young man, you're going off to save the world in a sense, or save us from somebody else, which happened to be the Japanese at the time. And I grew up with Japanese. Some of my best friends were Japanese growing up, going to school in Huntington Beach. And it was sort of a hard thing to hate the Japanese because I loved my friends, you know, but you have that feeling. They're the enemy. And so, like I remember when I was assigned to the Marine Corps, one of the first things I ever remember Captain O'Brien saying, he always made me an example because I was a chief, and he'd say, "Who's coming back in the box? It's the last guy that pulls the trigger." So that's just about it. And that's the, you have to, I don't want to say that's a mentality set, but that's just it. Who's coming back in the box? And I was lucky I didn't.
Well, and you know, what strikes me here, you mentioned to us that you were a licensed embalmer. You had worked in funeral homes. So death is nothing new for you. You've been around dead bodies before. But it sounds like, even for you, it was a shock to your system to have to undertake that task with the casualties of the Pearl Harbor attacks and taking those bodies out and identifying. It sounds like even to you, who'd been exposed to things like that, that this was really morbid and difficult.
Well, the average funeral director isn't exposed really to bodies that are months decaying, and the normality of it. I mean, how many, you know, it was, you just, a funeral director in his lifetime wouldn't use hardly any body bags to speak of compared to what we do in 10 minutes, maybe. It's just something that's, it's hard. It's hard to even talk about it. It's hard to accept that man can just do this to himself. I mean, not just to himself, but to everybody else. We're all supposed to be God's creatures, but boy, we sure don't take and treat each other in a loving manner.
Do you think there was something that helped you get through that? Because it sounds torturous. Do you think there was something you were able to focus on, or remind yourself of, or something that helped you get through that?
Well, you have to get up in the morning and put your shoes on and do your job. And I think my attitude was that you make the best of it. And when I was growing up, my sister always, I had an older sister, more like a mother, and she instilled into me that if you're going to do it, do it the best you can. And when you get in, you just take and roll up your sleeves and get at it, because it's not going to go away, so you might as well get in there and do it. But to say that you get adjusted to that type of thing, I don't think it's appalling, but you just have to keep on going, you know.
And at that time, the decision had not been made yet. I mean, you've got the Arizona still there and the Oklahoma probably and the Utah and these ships that had been hit there. And I'm sure they hadn't made the decision to leave the Arizona in the harbor and leave some of those bodies entombed that way. When you think about that now and you think about the things that you had to do, are you glad that that decision was made, that they decided to let those bodies rest where they still are?
Oh, yeah. I think it'd been just as well if all of them had stayed there. That was their ship. And when you're in the service, your duty station or whatever you happen to be is your home. Knowing the circumstances and what we were doing and everything else, yeah. Because even then you had people be questioning, say, well, how do you know that you got this is my son? Well, because he had a broken right arm, and we could tell it was broken. It had been broken in three places, and on his medical record, it had that. I'm just using that as sort of like an example. Or when we had to go in. I'm getting to a stage. I don't like to think about this, but we had to take and chart all your teeth and everything else, and you had a molar filled and all that, and that's how they identified a lot of people. And now we're just talking about human remains that are hardly anything there. The skeleton, and you go to take a shoe off, and it's all yuck material in there because it was contained in there. Boy, the stench, you stand up wind, you know, stand down wind, you know. But the one thing about it is if you're ever around anything, when there's a smoke or whatever it is, your olfactory nerve, that's what you smell with, is kind to you. In about a minute, it adapts to anything, and you won't notice how bad it smells. Somebody else walking in will say, "What stinks?" And you'll say, "I don't know what it is."
That sounds like a great relief to you at the time. And I imagine you were very relieved when that task was finished and you didn't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, I got another detail as fast as I could. I think that's when I volunteered to go on night duty, because that got me away from that other stuff.
In all the years since, have you ever been back to Pearl Harbor? Have you visited the Arizona Memorial?
I went back in about, 1982. I was over there. I had a son that was over there in business, and I went over there, but I didn't. I went out and took a look, but there wasn't anything that I really was home anymore. It's all changed. And I didn't go to the memorial. I saw it over there, but I didn't. I'd seen enough.
Would have been too difficult for you.
Oh, I guess. Yeah, it's, you know, you think the futility of all of it, you know, and you have, like in the Navy, we used to say, well, don't make friends, because you're always going through the turmoil in a sense of losing a friend or your friendship, even though it's not death. I'm just talking about that you're reassigned and you try to. I wouldn't want any other young person to ever have to go through. I have grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and some of my kids have been in the service and served overseas in Vietnam and that, and I had some that didn't come home, that's how it is.
Well, and you know, every veteran that I've ever interviewed has a very distinct memory about hearing the news of Pearl Harbor, the effect that it had on America and the way that the country united after that is remarkable, and a lot of stories are told about that, but I often hear the individual stories that veterans were motivated by that, and I'm curious if you having to experience the aftermath the way you did, if that gave you added incentive for America to win the war, if that motivated you more and reminded you of how great a task was in front of you.
Oh, I think, I don't know, I think I just got up every day and said I have to go to work and whatever it is, and you try to do the best you can, and you find out that, like in the medical corps, you're never supposed to carry a weapon. Well, I was on our landing when we were going to go in. I was carrying very few medical supplies, but I had weapons, and I was going to go in, and we were told that nothing lived. And I said to Captain O'Brien, what do you mean nothing lives? And he says, the cockroach doesn't live. And I said, what do you mean? He said, it's going to be nothing lives. He said, nothing lives. Get that into your head. He said, nothing lives. And even the kids, I mean, there was nothing. When you went in, it was until, thank goodness the Japs gave up. We didn't have to go through that. No kidding. I mean, but that was, it was hard for me to accept that you could, but you had to set your mind to who's coming home in the box. That was the answer.
And I want to get back to that, but let's talk about some of your patients that you had there in Hawaii. Admiral William Bull Halsey, a lot of stories have been told about him. He was an accomplished aviator before he took on the admiralty. He was famously tough. That's where he got his nickname. Had his reputation preceded him when he became your patient? Had you heard a story or two about him?
No, I don't think I hardly. I knew he was Admiral Halsey, and that he was sick, and I always thought the poor old guy had psoriasis, but they thought he had some exotic skin disorder.
Now, this was actually secret at the time. The Navy didn't want anyone to know that Admiral Halsey was sick and in the hospital. He had been aboard the USS Enterprise when the aircraft carrier came back into Pearl Harbor immediately after the Japanese attack. He had commanded the task force that launched that daring Doolittle raid, and according to Kenneth Friedman's book, Morning of the Rising Sun, the heroic story of the battles for Guadalcanal, when Halsey visited Admiral Chester Nimitz at Pearl Harbor, Halsey had lost 20 pounds and looked gaunt and exhausted. He checked himself into the hospital with a debilitating case of dermatitis, that's what the book calls it, and in what he would later call the most grievous disappointment of his career, he had to temporarily give up command of his two-carrier task force. Those two carriers, the Enterprise and the Hornet, scored that great victory at Midway. But while all of that was unfolding, Halsey was stuck there in the hospital as a patient of our guest today, Lloyd Bledsoe. And he wasn't wearing his stars, sleeve stripes, or shoulder boards. I guess he wasn't even wearing pajamas or a gown, because whatever he wore exacerbated that skin condition, huh?
He was going around in his birthday suit, and was on the second deck of the hospital, and I said, Admiral, I said, you can't go around like this, sir, just like that. And he looked at me sort of funny, and I said, well, his master of the arms on the war just like that to him. I said, you know, not this, that supersedes your authority, sir, but the nurses across the street looking over here and laughing, what's going on up here? And he says, well, he said, if they've never seen one before, they won't know what it is. If they have, it won't be anything new. And that was Admiral Halsey. I mean, he wasn't there too long, and he came back to the States, and I was on night duty, and I had other people in there to think about, and he was, I got him, went down, and I was in the laundry, and I saw these silk pajamas, and I got them cleaned up for him. And went back up, and I finally got him to wear those silk pajamas because they didn't seem to bother him that much. But he was going around, and what did people say if they saw me in these damn silky things? You know, he was a good guy. It was hard, but when you're there and you have as a patient and you're taking care of him, it's rank and your ratings and all that kind of stuff. I never thought about that. I was there to take care of you, and just like I'm thinking now about some of the things at the Battle of Midway. Of course, those days the pilots wore a leather helmet and goggles, and they'd come and they'd be badly burned in the hands and the face, but they'd have these big white spots where the goggles had protected their eyes. In those days, we didn't have. We didn't have penicillin. We didn't know what it was. We didn't have, we had aspirin. Sulfa drugs were just coming along. When they'd try to treat the burns on the face, they came up with a concoction of mineral oil and sulfa drugs. They tried to red that up and tap that on your face with cotton. Well, when you got a beard, because you can't shave over your stuff, well, that didn't work. And so then they tried to we use gauze to pat it on there with. And I used to give the saucer with a concoction in there and tell him, the patient, I said, put this on yourself because I don't want to hurt you, and you can keep patting it when you feel it get dry. And so I just left the medication there so they could take and put it on. We were more of a receiving hospital. As soon as they could get them to get up and out and back to the States, well, they came back to the States.
Well, I do have some more questions for you on that when we come back. A reminder first of a few events coming up that you will not want to miss. We've heard a little music on the show today. If you want to hear a whole bunch of great patriotic music, you need to catch the Sounds of Freedom Military Band and its special Armed Forces Day concert on Sunday, May 20th. That'll be at 2 o'clock at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building. Admission is free. And Miss Fresno County 2011 Valerie Salcido will even be singing with the band. That's Sunday, May 20th for the award-winning Sounds of Freedom Band in Clovis. The day before that, May 19th, Hometown Heroes will be out on location at Carrington Point at Cedar and Alluvial in Fresno. Come on out and say hello between 1 and 2 o'clock. I'd love to see you, and there's going to be some great food. You can learn about the retirement living experience there, too. And finally, don't forget Castle Air Museum's annual Strawberry Waffle Brunch a week from tomorrow on Sunday, May 6th. Great chance to see some historic aircraft, enjoy some terrific food with those wonderful folks at Castle Air Museum in Atwater. Okay, back to Corcoran's Lloyd Bledsoe and his story when Hometown Heroes continues after more from our sponsors, starting with my good friends at Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to continue now with 92-year-old Lloyd Bledsoe. He's already described for us that gruesome task of trying to identify the decaying bodies of some of the more than 2,000 Americans killed at Pearl Harbor. Later, we chuckled as he recalled the kind of patient Admiral William Bull Halsey had been at the hospital there at Pearl. He obviously got some pretty good care if he returned to command and scored so many more victories in World War II. He, of course, was there in Tokyo Bay on the USS Missouri when the Japanese signed the surrender documents. But there were so many patients who did not carry the rank or fame of Admiral Halsey. You treated many of those who came back after the Battle of Midway, and I don't want to make it overly dramatic or anything,
but it sounds like every day you were exposed to really the price of freedom and what
Americans were suffering for the greater cause. And Midway was one of the greatest victories of the war for the Americans. But you saw these heavy casualties coming back to you. And I imagine you probably witnessed some pretty good displays of courage with those patients and what they had gone through and what their outlooks were. Do you remember anything that maybe inspired you during that time?
When I came back from home, I brought a shipload of Marines back, casualties. I mean, not really casualties, but I mean patients. And I had a corporal on crutches. And he had been at the hospital where I was. And I'd known a bit about his history because we generally didn't keep patients too long there. But he had an infection. And they were arguing about whether they were going to take his legs off, and he wouldn't let him cut his legs off. And Commander Pugh, the operating surgeon, I remember him talking about it was horrible to think that you would be cutting a man's legs off and one thing and the other. And so they suffered through. And by golly, when I was coming back home, lo and behold, this fellow was a patient of mine on the ship, and he was on crutches. It took us 5 days to come back across from Hawaii here to San Francisco. About the third day, I went up, I take care of him in the morning, and he's had one crutch. And I said, Corporal, where's the other crutch? Oh, I threw this thing over this overside. But I think that guy and I walked all the way back across the Pacific because he was going to walk again. And if I ever had anybody that I ever said that had real intestinal fortitude, it was that corporal. And I often wondered what happened to him. And when we came down the gangplank, off the ship, and going to our bus to take us to where we were going to go, he was going to a hospital, and that's the last I saw of him. He was struggling, but he didn't have any crutches, and he was hobbling along, and the sweat pouring off of him, but he was walking. And I often wondered what happened to him. But when you're in the service, you don't, or at least I didn't, and I was more or less taught to not to get too close and to get into it because it's too much of an upheaval. You're always dealing with your friends or somebody gets hurt, and you just have to say, hey, put your shoes on and get to work, and when you're finished where you're going, don't think any more about it.
Well, I'm sure, especially in your line of work, where a lot of the people you're interacting with, you don't know if they're going to make it or not. And with that soldier and that Marine with the crutches, it sounds like that's something that you remember, and it's been nearly 70 years since then, but it sounds like in your mind that's the epitome of determination and willpower and courage?
Yeah. As I said before, if I ever in my lifetime have had anybody that had guts and determination, it was that corporal.
Now, what about you during this time? You had met this young lady before you shipped out. I imagine you're trying to at least stay in touch with her and send some letters back and forth?
Every day. I had a letter every day, in and out. I wrote to her and she wrote to me, and we sit around nowadays and say, what did we write about? And I said, probably what we do here as we sit here. We sit back and reminisce over the same thing.
So you were writing these letters back and forth. When did you decide that you wanted to ask her to marry you?
On our first date when I got back, I said something about, well, you're still here, just like that. She said, yeah. And I said, you'll be here after the war? She said, yeah. And I said, you mean you'd marry me? She said, yeah. And so I said, we eloped and got married, just about like that. We didn't elope that day, but I mean, I didn't tell my mother I was going to get married, but I thought it was only right that I'd say something to her mother and father if it was okay with I married their daughter. And they were glad to get rid of her, I guess, because they said, yeah, I got her. No, that's not a nice thing to say. But see, my wife and I, as I'm on here on this telephone, we have never had a bad word. Never. Never.
In 68 years. Well, and I guess you had to come home and marry her on a leave or something?
I was I had a 30-day leave before I was assigned to San Leandro Naval Hospital. That was just going into commission. In fact, I was on the commissioning staff when we put that in up there. It was supposed to be part of Oak Knoll, but they decided the compound was too complicated. Plus, at San Leandro, we had rehabilitation almost 100% for Marines from the South Pacific. And it was back, if you've ever been there, but it's back up in the hills behind Oakland. And at that time, it was, it was a trip to get to it. And it was isolated. And then the guys coming back, I'll tell you what, it's hard for anybody to really realize what our young people go through, not just because I was there. I was extremely fortunate in my service, but some of the kids aren't.
Well, and you were exposed on a daily basis to those who weren't so fortunate, right?
Oh, yeah, but I was the lucky one, and I still had my limbs. I've seen fellas, when I was on night duty, it was my job post-surgery, they'd be coming out, and I was the guy that got to tell them they had any hands or legs again. Boy, it gets to you after a while. In fact, I finally got away from, I got a different assignment. I was assigned to the commissary. I got assigned to a commissary. I had a nurse that I'd worked with up on the ward, and she was in charge of the diet kitchen and the stuff at the, they call it commissary that in the Navy. And Judy Wilson was her name. She got me to come down and be on her staff to get away from what I was doing. I got started where I was really more, instead of being a Navy corpsman, I was more of a storekeeper. I ran a ship service. I was a ship service specialist. And then when I went to the Marine Corps, it was going to be a whole different ball game going back again. But then that's just part of it. You get your orders. When I got orders to the Marine Corps, my executive officer called me up and he said, "Hey, Chief," he says, "this time tomorrow you're going to be on your way to San Diego and Camp Pendleton Marines. You're a Marine." Now, and I said, "Oh, you got to be kidding." He said, "Well, I know you got a lot of things to do." He said, "You can have my Jeep all day tomorrow," he said, "to take care of things," which I thought was wonderful. And then when I left, my wife was surprised. They came in and took care of her and moved her and did the whole. She didn't have to do anything, and we had a little baby about that time, and she was amazed at how they took care of her, but they really took good care of her.
How hard was that for you? I mean, when you had shipped out to Pearl earlier, you weren't married yet. Now you had a wife and a little baby, and they're telling you that you're going to go invade Japan, and they even told you better make out a will, right?
Well, when I got to the Marine Corps, yeah. We had to make out our last will and testament, make sure you had your $10,000 insurance.
But you're shipping out with all these Marines, and you already told us you had more ammunition and weapons than you did medical supplies, practically. Did you think that you were going to come back when you shipped out, and what was going through your mind?
Well, I don't know what the heck was going through my mind, because you're going to go, you know, you say your goodbyes, and that's just part of the game when you're in there. It's not a game, but, I mean, that's just it. What are you going to do, say no? The no is a firing squad, just about. But, that's what it is. Just like I said before, I was a lucky guy. I came back, and I had some things that maybe I didn't like, and I won't even talk about them, but that's just part of it. And the futility is an old man looking back on things, and even today, the futility of all the turmoil that we have in our young people. And I had a boy that used to come here. I'd come in my home here. He was just like my son, and he was chasing my oldest daughter, who would be here in a minute maybe, and he'd be in here lying on the floor, sound asleep. He never came back from Vietnam, but he picked up and went, and he was a volunteer. He didn't want to think that he had a stigma being drafted, and those of us that, I guess, volunteered to go in, we always sort of figure, well, we knew they were going to call us, so before they called us, we volunteered. We had a better feeling about it, I guess. We thought, well, you know, so here comes the postman. I run down and volunteer.
Are you one of those who feels that because you were in the invasion force to go to Japan and the chances of you coming back were not great, do you feel that the atomic bombs saved your life?
Oh, man, I sure did. I mean, I remember we were at Camp Pendleton, and the news came with the first bomb, and boy, we were around the radios, what in the heck is going on and everything else, and boy, what's going to happen, And of course, this is right in the time that we had our footlockers and everything packed, and then our billets aboard the ship who were going to leave, and they put that on hold. And then I guess it was 2 days in there, something like that. And then the second one in the war was over.
When you think back on World War II now, as someone who saw all the things you saw, from the aftermath at Pearl Harbor to all the wounded veterans that you treated, when people ask you about World War II now and why it's important, why it's significant, what do you tell them?
Well, I don't think it was significant of anything. They're still fighting. There isn't any peace. And if you wanted to look at it from the other side, if somebody is under, if they think that they are not being treated fairly, and in all honesty, maybe they're not being, if they can rise up against you, if they have their day, they're going to say, my day has come. And I think in the world, in the corporate structure, there's so much that goes on that we don't even know about. But you look in the papers, you read the headlines now, we have problems with that. I'm going to get into part of it, but we have problems. And people that are in positions of trust are not trustworthy. They spend money like you got a spigot turned on, and where does the water come from, huh? But I'm not going to be able to change it, and you're not going to be able to change that. It's just the way it is.
And you have certainly earned the right to share your opinions with us. Of course, I want to thank you for myself and on behalf of all our listeners for your service to our country. I know you've served so many families so well for so long here in the Corcoran area, too. I know we're about out of time, but I do have one more question for you. After everything you went through in the war and the life that you've been able to live since then and the big family that you have, what would you say that you're most thankful for?
Well, still being here. And, well, I've had a good life. What am I thankful for? I'm not thankful for that you have to have wars, but I'm thankful that I've been able to have a good life. And you just see my wife here, and she's put up with me for 60, 70 years, whatever it is. And I've been chasing her 70 years, I guess. And we still have all our plates.
You still have all your plates, so you mean she hasn't thrown any at you yet? I think I just heard her say, though, that you've been chasing her 70 years, but you haven't caught her yet, so keep at it.
Oh, well, I better get going or I'll...
Yeah, you better follow those orders from headquarters. If you would like to see what Lloyd and Pat Bledsoe look like after 68 years of marriage, you can check out the story at kmjnow.com, or, of course, you can always visit the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. This was a little different show today, certainly a unique perspective, and I don't know about you, but I really appreciated the candor in this conversation. Remember, if you have a World War II veteran in your life that you think I ought to catch up with, you can email me, paul@kmjnow.com. That's easy enough, right? paul@kmjnow.com. Don't forget, the show's going to be out live 3 weeks from today on May 19th. Come out and catch all the KMJ programming up through 2 o'clock on Saturday, May 19th at Carrington Point, on Alluvial, just east of Cedar in Fresno. Thanks so much for listening today, and please join us again next Saturday for Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
History in every century records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall as into line we fall the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory. Let's remember Pearl Harbor.
places that this heart and mind embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well, I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.